Good morning. It's good to see everybody this morning, and good to see some visitors and see some faces haven't seen for a little while, and see a few others this morning. Just so y'all know, I apologize. I wasn't shaking hands and saying good morning to everybody. I've got something going on, and you don't want whatever it is. So I'm staying away from everybody. So I'm going to preach this morning, and I'm going to leave. So Sunday school classes will both be together. Ken's going to teach this morning. So I just feel better about not letting anybody else have what I have if it's contagious. So I apologize for that. And one other announcement, thought crossing my mind this morning. I know some of you are regulars, some of you aren't, but there's in the pew backs, in the seat backs in front of you, there's some tan-colored, yellowish-colored cards that are just information cards. And here's the thing. I've been sitting down with Ronnie, and we're going to start putting the prayer request. If you're on the prayer chain this last week, you got just a summary of the prayer requests from Sunday morning. And the reason is because sometimes I hear those on Sunday morning, and by Sunday afternoon I've forgotten what somebody asked us to pray for. And so I'm sure that others do as well. And so we're going to start putting those together every Monday and just sending out those to people. And besides, if you aren't here on Sunday morning, that way you get an idea of who we're praying for. You know, as part of the body, lifting each other up in prayer is an important thing that we can do and get to do. And so I want to share that with you. But then if you have a prayer request that you don't want to be shared in that manner, put it on one of those cards, and those will be given to me or to one of the elders at the end of church instead of being given to Ronnie. And that way, just if you don't want that going out, we just want to give you that opportunity. And also, if you need something else that isn't a prayer request, that's what those cards are for. And so we'd love for you to use those in that manner. So, you know, we love being able to serve each other and worship together. And, you know, worship isn't just about this hour on Sunday morning. It's about how we live life together and how we serve one another as we go out of here. So this is all a part of how we do that. So where do you turn when your world falls apart? Well, what if your world is rocked by the ones who are supposed to be our support? A cheating spouse files for divorce. A friend who said they would always have your back turns on you. A person who was supposed to protect and provide walks out, or worse yet, is abusive in some form or fashion. A church that was supposed to be family turned their back on you in the midst of your pain, or maybe they were part of causing that very same pain. When police kill the citizens that they're supposed to protect, when armies kill innocent people, seemingly for pleasure. The list could go on and on. What do you do if the diagnosis of a disease, the loss of a job, a painful injury, a confidant that moves or betrays a confidence, or a social stigma that you can no longer handle? Where do you turn when your world falls apart? Well, what if it isn't just that your world falls apart, but what if that you feel like Job? You know the story of Job. Job just had this sense that God was against him. And that's why in Job chapter 13, verse 15, he says, "Though he slay me." Though he, speaking of God, "though he slay me, I will hope in him." We could use the word trust in him, like the old King James Version, or we could say have confidence in him. Whatever it is, it's we trust God. Where do you turn when your world falls apart? Too often we turn from God. Too often we turn to anger. We might turn to despondency. We might turn to one drug or another to mask our pain. Yet we're all still searching for a better way to deal with our pain and our suffering. This morning we're going to turn to the Psalm chapter 142. And here I think that we'll find a better way to deal with our pain and suffering. This psalm is attributed to David while he was running from King Saul. His world has fallen apart. Everything that he knows has been taken away from him. The promises that God has made seem less than sure. And David is hiding at the back of a cave. Hiding like a chased animal in a cage. And I think that if we look at what David says, we find that there's a better way to deal with our pain and our suffering. And David says, I cry to the Lord. I lift up my voice to the Lord for mercy. I pour out my complaint before Him. Before Him I tell my trouble. When my spirit grows faint within me, it is You who know my way. In the path where I walk, men have hidden a snare for me. Look to my right and see, no one is concerned for me. I have no refuge, no one cares for my life. I cry to You, O Lord. I say, You are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Listen to my cry, for I am in desperate need. Rescue me from those who pursue me, for they are too strong for me. Set me free from my prison, that I may praise Your name. Then the righteous will gather about me because of Your goodness to me. Lynn Gardner, in his book on pain and suffering, identifies four ways that we can respond to pain and suffering. He says, one, we can trust God. Second, he says we can question God. Third, we can blame God. And finally, we can reject God. And here's what I've experienced in nearly 20 years of ministry and 20 years of visiting with people who are dealing with pain and suffering. It's this, is that too often we run from Christ when we should run to Him. Too often we turn our focus on Him and blame Him when we should be seeking His comfort, peace, wisdom, grace, mercy, love, and most of all, His presence. And if you remember one thing this morning, it's that too often we run from God when we should run to Him. And I see David. David tells us this in four different things this morning. He identifies four things for us that we need to understand and we need to turn and we need to trust God. The first one is this, is that we need to identify our pain and suffering. We need to be able to identify our pain and suffering. And if you look at this psalm is what is called a lament. Now, the lament psalms are just this. They are a very honest appraisal of a bad situation to God. It's the author looking at a dire situation that they're in and turning it, and they're voicing their frustration, they're voicing their pain, they're voicing their situation to God. And here is David. He three different ways he identifies his pain to God. The first one is supplication. It says, I lift up my voice to the Lord. I lift up my voice to the Lord. Here's David. You can see him in the back of a cave hiding from King Saul. And he says, I lift up my voice to God. There's only one reason when you're in the back of a cave you lift up your voice to God. And that is you need something. Things aren't going well. Things aren't going the way that you think they should. And you lift up your voice to God. Now, most of us probably won't find ourselves hiding in the back of a cave. But what if you find yourself laying flat on the bed in a hospital room? Or what if you find yourself alone in a bed, wondering why? What if you find yourself sitting where no one wants to sit, like Job in the ash piles scraping your boils with potsherds. What is it? But here's the thing. I don't know where that dark cave is for you, but what I know is that in those moments, the first thing that David does is he says, I lift up my voice to the Lord. I make my supplication to God. And then he says, I pour out my complaint to God. You see, we don't want to let God know how we really feel about things. But one of the great things about the Psalms, if you read through the Psalms, there is no lack of emotion that is shared by the psalmists. They share their praise, they share their thanksgiving, they share their heart, but oftentimes they share their frustration and they vent with honest language to God. And the great thing is Pemberton notes that as you read through the Psalms, they're not specific about what it is they're going through, because the psalmists want them to be applicable to every situation. So you might find little bits and pieces about what they were going through, but more often than not, they're really kind of general, because you know what? You and I face the same kinds of situations, even if we don't face the same situation. And so the psalmist, they lift up their complaint to God, and David said, God, here's everything that's going wrong. I'm going to complain to you, God, because things aren't right. And as we move forward, you'll see that it isn't that David is just venting his anger, like you might do if things don't go your way and you're just frustrated and you just start venting. But there is a purpose and there is a reason behind this. And David will get to where it moves from just stating what's wrong to the relationship. And then there is the declaration. David identifies his pain and suffering through his declaration. You know, he goes to God and in supplication, he goes to God in complaint, and then it says, before him I will tell my trouble. He's going to declare to God exactly what is wrong. In specific terms, he's going to tell God exactly what is wrong. God, this is what I am going through. This is what I think you should have done already that you have not done. God, this is it. And he's going to be very real in his declaration to God. And for us today, we can identify these same times. The first one is when we're just spiritually overwhelmed. Have you ever been spiritually overwhelmed? Been at that place where you just feel like you have been backed into the darkest cave you could ever face and you can't see the way out anymore? When spiritually you just don't think that there is any hope for where you're standing for things to ever get better. You see, that's where David is at. He's at the back of the cave. God has promised him he's going to be king, yet he's running from Saul. He probably thought, hey, I'm going to learn how to be king from King Saul and things are going to go great. And instead, Saul is hunting him like a wild animal. And there are times in life when we feel like we're spiritually overwhelmed, where it seems like one thing just piles on top of another and we feel like we're running from one thing when another thing chases us and we're hiding in that cave. And we're trapped. Have you ever felt trapped? Trapped in a situation that you just don't think you can get out of? Trapped with a disease that you don't think will ever get better? Trapped in some relational difficulty that you don't see a solution for? We get trapped. And David is there. And we can be too. But the worst comes when David says that there's no one there. Look to my right and see, no one is concerned for me, he says. You know, your right-hand side is, if you were going into a court of law, it's where your defender would stand, on your right hand. If you were going into battle, don't we all want a right-hand man?
We want somebody to stand there to protect us. And when you can't go on, the person that you want there, you want on your right side to give you strength. And David said, there's God, there's nobody there. There's nobody on my right side, God. Nobody cares anymore.
And I like what the German commentators, Kyle and Delitzsch, say about this. It says, the fact that David, although surrounded by a band of loyal subjects, confesses to having no true friend is to be understood similarly to the language of Paul when he says in Philippians 2:20, I have no man like-minded. All human love, since sin has taken possession of humanity, is more or less selfish, and all fellowship of faith and love imperfect, and there are circumstances in life in which these dark sides make themselves felt overpoweringly, so that a man seems to himself to be perfectly isolated and turns all the more urgently to God, who alone is able to supply the soul's want of some object to love, whose love is absolutely unselfish and unchangeable and unbeclouded, to whom the soul can confide without reserve whatever burdens it, and who not only honestly desires its good, but is also able to compass it in spite of every obstacle.
You see, don't we want that? Don't we want somebody who's there no matter what we're going through, who isn't going to pass judgment? Somebody who's going to stand there and listen to every complaint and simply identify with us.
Then David goes and identifies the second thing that we need to do, and that is he identifies the help. He identifies the one who can help. He looks, and throughout this passage he says, O Lord, and the Lord there in our English translations is actually the Hebrew word Yahweh. And in saying Yahweh, he is using the covenant name for God. You see, they had a generic term that they would use for God, and that is the name El. And we see it throughout the Scriptures in different names for God, Elohim, El Elyon, El Shaddai. The names that they would give to God that were, this is God, and then they would add to that. But then God gave to them His covenant name, and the covenant name was Yahweh. I am that I am. And David uses that name. He doesn't use the more generic term, but he uses the covenant name for God, because here's what David is saying. He's saying in context, the only one that can help me is the God of the covenant. And in identifying that it's God of the covenant, he's identifying that there is this relationship that's already been made between David and between God. David, as a member of the covenant, is in relationship with the God of the covenant. And sometimes we just need to stop and identify who it is that can help us. And the first thing that David identifies about him is that it's the covenant God. Then he goes on and he says that you are my refuge. You are my refuge. You know, how many times do we need somewhere to go where we can get away from the storms of life? Someplace that we can go where there's safety from everything that seems to be going on around us. A place where nothing can harm us. And David says, you are my refuge. You alone, God, you are the one that I can turn to protect me and to provide. You are the one who will give me safety. God, you are my refuge. And then he says, you are my portion. My portion in the land of the living. Now, we probably missed what this is saying. But when David is saying this, Walter Zorn says this. He says, God has helped in the past. Is it unreasonable to believe that He is ready to help again? God has been and is His
refuge, and he has no other. God has been his portion. This word has special significance. When the land of Canaan was distributed to the tribes of Israel, the priestly tribe of Levi was allotted no possession in the land except a place to live. Instead, God would be their portion. And they would live by the Israelites' tithes and offering. Without land, a person could not live. And the Levites had to trust God that he would provide, that he would be their portion and their livelihood. And here is David. He says, God, you alone can provide. You are my portion. I don't need anything else. There's nothing else that can sustain me. There's nothing else that can give me life. There's nothing else but you. You are my portion. And he turns to God. And then he identifies the fact that God is trustworthy. God, you are the one who has been good to me. You are the one I turn to. He says in the last verse, he says, then the righteous will gather about me because of your goodness to me. David identifies the fact that he's turning to God because God is trustworthy. Even though the world around him is falling apart, even though Saul is trying to kill him, he isn't sure that he can have a real confidant in his soldiers. David turns to God and he says, God, you are trustworthy. I can trust you and you alone. And this is where we need to be. We need to come to the point where we're identifying the fact that God alone is our help. God alone is our refuge and our portion. And that God is trustworthy. And then David goes a step further. He identifies his pain. He identifies the help that he's turning to. And then he makes his request. He makes his request to God. He says, God, hear me. God, listen to me. God, you're up there, and I know you are. Now listen to me and hear what I have to say. You notice this isn't the first thing David does, but David saves this until he's working through the process. He's working through this process, and he gets to the point where he now is willing to lift up his request to God, and he says, God, hear me. And this isn't just I hear your voice, I see your lips moving, and I hear your voice because my eardrum is moving. This is, God, listen and really understand what it is I'm saying. This would be like your child coming up to you when they don't think you're paying attention and grabbing you by both cheeks and saying, listen to me, I'm talking to you. Have you ever had your kids do that to you? They get your attention. They want to know that you're paying attention to them. And this is what David is doing to God. Well, he really can't because God isn't there. But figuratively speaking, this is what David is doing. He's saying, God, listen to me. Let me make myself clear. Hear me. And sometimes we need to stop and we need to get right with God and we need to say, God, listen to me. Not because God isn't paying attention, but because we need to focus and we need God to listen and we need to know He's listening to us. And so he asks God to hear him, and then he moves on and he says, God, deliver me. God, this is the situation I'm going through, and I need You. You are the only one who can get me through to the other side. God, deliver me. I think it's interesting. David doesn't say to God exactly how he wants Him to deliver him. He just says, rescue me from those who pursue me. God, set me free from my prison. God, deliver me. And I think sometimes we need to go to God and we just need to say, God, I need You to heal me. I don't know what that means, God, but I need You to heal me. God, I need You to rescue me. I don't know what that means. But other times we need to come to God and we need to say, God, this is the situation I'm facing and this is what I need You to do. God, I need You to deliver me, to set me free from... And then you just lay it out before Him. Because we serve a God who is the deliverer, the one who can deliver us. And David says that, God, I want You to deal bountifully with me. God, I don't just want You to deliver me, but I want You to do great things for me. Set me free from my prison and then gather the righteous around me. God, set me free from prison and then do good things for me. And we need to be honest with God about what it is that we want. We need to trust that God listens and hears, and we need to be honest with Him. Sometimes, James says that sometimes we don't have because we don't ask. Sometimes we don't receive from God because we're afraid to ask. And I think that James isn't saying that we don't go to God in prayer, but I think James is saying that we don't receive because we're really quite general in our prayer requests. Instead of coming and believing that God wants to do good for us, we just ask this blanket prayer, God bless me. Instead of saying, God, I need a good job to pay the bills. Please provide a job. God, this is the illness that I'm dealing with, and I need You to do something about it. Even if it's simply giving the doctor some great insight into what's going on so that You can work through their wisdom to bring healing and to bring relief. And we just need to be honest with God about what it is that we really want and ask Him to deal bountifully with us. This is what David does. And once he identifies the request, then he identifies the results. Because you see, David is doing this in the context of a relationship. He isn't just looking out for himself. He isn't just saying, I want to be healed. I want to be freed. I want to do this for myself. But he says, God, first and foremost, I want this so that I can praise You and so that other people will praise You. He says in verse 7, he says, so that I may praise Your name. He says, then the righteous will gather about me because of Your goodness to me. He says, first of all, God, I want You to free me and bring me safely to the promise that You have given me because I personally, I want to give You praise and I want to give You honor. I want to be back amongst Your people and I want to be able to go up to Your house to worship You. God, I want to bring You praise. But then he also says, so that everybody around me can praise You. Because here's what David knew. David knew that God was working in his life. David knew that God had promised him he would be king, but yet he's hiding in the back of the cave, and he wants to see God glorified. And he's waiting for God to move. So that when God makes him the king, when God brings him into the place that he has promised him, that God will get the glory from those around him. You know, sometimes we ask, James says, we ask for our own good, and so we don't get things too. But David says that our response should be, God, I want this so that you will be glorified, that you will be praised when you do what you ask, or what I ask. And then David goes, and he also says, here's what I want, God. Here's what I really want. I want you to free me from this prison. God, I don't want to have to dwell in this cave any longer. God, I don't want to have to run around in the desert and the dry places any longer. God, I don't have to want to wonder if the next village I go to is going to turn me into Saul, or they won't turn me into Saul, and then something bad will happen to them. God, I want freedom. And David isn't afraid to say this to God and to tell God exactly what he wants. That these are the results that I want to see. The request and the results, and they go hand in hand. John Mark Hicks writes in the book, Yet I Will Trust Him. He says that we need to learn to trust God even when God doesn't, as he says, come through. But these are his words. He says, but this was the essence of the test. Will Job believe even when he has no reason to believe? Will he maintain his integrity when there is no profit or gain? You see, we need to learn that even when we identify the results that we want, we need to learn to identify the results that we're seeing. And here's the question. Here's the question. Will we trust God even when what we want doesn't come through? This is where Job is at. In Job chapter 13, he says, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. If things don't turn out the way I want them to, I will still trust God. I won't be silent about what I want. I won't be silent about where I am. I won't be silent. But if God doesn't answer my request in my way, I will still trust Him. Will Job maintain his integrity? Will you maintain yours? Judd Wilhite, in his book Torn, speaking about the name it, claim it theology, or the health, wealth gospel, he says this. He says, this prosperity gospelish sort of passive-aggressive blackmail has caused massive pain, and it leads to a cycle of frustration. See, I'm not saying that we can tell God exactly what we want and He's going to do it. Sometimes He doesn't do things according to our plan. He doesn't do things according to our purpose, and He doesn't do things according to our timeline. Do you know that? Have you experienced that? So I can't stand up here and tell you if you just have enough faith that God will make everything right. I can't tell you if you pray the right prayers, everything will be perfect. I'm not telling you this morning that if you identify the problem, and you identify your help, and you go to God with your requests and tell Him what you want, that you're going to see the exact results. Because you know what? I know better. I've seen people that didn't get what they asked for, but they got something better. They get God. Lynn Gardner says this. He says, suffering prompts thoughts about God. Anger, bitterness, and a clenched fist towards God are common responses to suffering. Any believers question and doubt God as they struggle with suffering. Others reject God, or the God of the Bible, and create in their mind a God acceptable to them. Still others reject the idea of God completely. Some respond by trusting God and knowing His grace
is sufficient. How people respond to the suffering and evil is directly related to the response to God. You see, this is where David is at. David is in this place where pain and suffering and evil is all around him. But David, because he knows that God is trustworthy, because he knows of this relationship he has with God, David can say, "You are my strength. You are my refuge and my portion in the land of the living." John Mark Hicks says this. He says, "We must learn to live by revelation rather than reasoned judgments about the relationship between God and humanity. We must learn to live by faith and not by sight. For in revelation, God is not silent. He speaks, and He reveals Himself in ways that assure us of His faithfulness and love. There we find God's comforting presence. Only in the knowledge, contemplation, and experience of God can we come to endure misery with faith, integrity, and hope." You see, it's only in relationship. It's only in this covenant relationship with God the Father that we have hope that God will work for us. It's only in light of this covenant relationship that we can have faith that God is faithful. It's only in the covenant relationship that we see the integrity of God to do good for His people, no matter the circumstances. The question this morning is this, is will you trust Him? When your world falls apart, when everything is crumbling around you and it seems that there is no foundation left, will you trust God and stand firm on Him? Or will you seek your own answers to the problems of life? Because only God proves trustworthy. This morning, if you don't know Jesus as your Lord and Savior, if God is not the God of your life, we're going to sing a hymn of invitation, and I would love for you to begin to ask that question, what does this relationship look like? Because He wants to be there to strengthen and encourage you in all of the troubles and trials of life. He wants to be your portion and He wants to be your refuge. But you have to come to Him and believe that He will be. If you need to make a commitment this morning, won't you come as we stand together? If you just need somebody to pray with you, we'd love to do that as well. Won't you come as we stand together and sing, "Savior," or "Lead Me to the Cross"?